Well, I want to introduce you to the latest addition to my reference library. It's called The Oxford Companion to the Year, an exploration of calendar customs and time reckoning. The publisher's note says, "What are halcyon days? On what date do the dog days begin? What is Hansel Monday? How do Chinese, Muslim, Mesoamerican, Jewish, and Babylonian calendars differ from Christian calendars?" The answer to these and hundreds of other intriguing questions about the way humans have marked and measured time over the millennia can be found in The Oxford Companion to the Christian Year. That would be another cool book. Wishful thinking, I guess. Maybe a little dorky. Show of hands for people who don't think that's a totally dorky book to read. Okay, that's fine. I'll try not to bore my family with too many details about forgotten feast days and ancient rituals and seasonal oddities. But I've got to say, so far this year, when looking at Epiphany in 2011, which still feels a little weird to say, I found a bunch of details about feasts and carnivals and recipes for Epiphany cakes, which are also called king cakes. And you're supposed to bake them with a little bean or a trinket inside. And if you find it, you're the king of Epiphany for that year. What a good time. I didn't even know this. I also noticed that, interestingly enough, this is, like I said, not the Oxford Companion to the Christian year. Epiphany is the time of year where most cultures start practicing all sorts of folksy, homespun soothsaying and divination and rituals and floating leaves and basically doing little rites and ways of looking into the metaphysical almanac for the world, I guess you could say. They want to know what's ahead for the new year. And in ancient times, people who lived way further down the food chain than we do right now, at the mercy of the seasons, the viability of their crops, the health of their livestock, their overall vitality and fertility of their village, that these people would be asking questions like this, it's understandable. People wanted some answers, some indication that the elemental forces of nature and whomever or whatever was in charge, at the very least, wasn't going to bring blight or plague or famine. And even now, we're not so different. We want to know that our sons and daughters will flourish and have children of their own if we do have sons and daughters, that our investments will survive the market, that our homes will stay warm and healthy. Fortune telling of one form or another is an effort to give some semblance of order to what, in what appears to be an otherwise chaotic and unpredictable world. It's a way to get oriented in the bigger scheme of things. It's an effort to obtain a bearing and a heading as people who navigate our world. No, not just ancient people. If you've been reading the papers, there's recent hubbub about the revisions of the signs of the zodiac. Apparently I'm not an Aquarius anymore. Whatever that means, I can't claim to be an expert on that. As a rule, just to be clear, the scriptures condemn fortune-telling, astrology, magicians, the consulting of mediums, usually with pretty strong language, because God wants to remind his people that despite the world's frustrations and hazards, that God gets the last word. There are divine plans afoot, promises made, even if we don't always understand them. And what promises they are. Today is the second Sunday after Epiphany. We actually bumped the story of the three wise men to this week because we did the baptism of Jesus last Sunday. Epiphany is a Greek word. It means manifestation or striking appearance, sudden revelation. This post-Christmas season observes the first glimpses of the fulfillment of God's promises in the person of Jesus. Epiphany is the encounter with a God who reveals himself, a chance to reacquaint ourselves with the God we follow. At key points in the Hebrew scriptures, we're told stories of different epiphany moments, glimpses of God's self-revelation and disclosure, and of his far-reaching plans that he has for his people. Abraham, and his blood-drenched covenant ceremony with God. The promise his descendants would match the stars in number. Jacob, his wrestling match with God and the promise of a great nation. Moses, burning bush and the story of the rescue of that nation. Divine appearances, signs, prophets, oracles, words of assurance in times of judgment and exile. The God who has divine intentions for individuals and people calls them to follow, and then steps in and reveals a part of that grand story. Even if the initial recipients never live to see it fulfilled, and even when they rebel and turn from their Maker, Epiphany marks the striking appearance of God in our world, the point to which all of these other stories of revelation and appearance have been leading. 2 weeks ago, in the first chapter of John's Gospel, we're told that God, the true light, which gives light to everyone, is coming into the world. John uses poetic images, philosophical language. He talks of deep truths. This week, Matthew's Gospel conveys that same deep truth in story. A story of people and places with surprising twists that tell not only the light of God is coming among us, but what this light and what its coming looks like. Traditionally, Epiphany celebrates the visitation of the three kings of the East. We three kings of Orient are three wise men who brought gifts sometime after the birth of Jesus. The typical nativity scene sets things up quite nicely. Three bearded kings on camels with little boxes and jars, typically one with dark skin, wearing jewel-encrusted turbans or crowns and royal robes. They even show up in traditional costume on our order of service this week, if you paid attention to that. A regal visit from foreign monarchs. The king of the Jews, esteemed and welcomed to earth by foreign dignitaries. The three kings bring a little class, a taste of the exotic, some romance to the party. One problem. The bulk of the story, as I've just recounted, and a whole lot more, just isn't in the Bible. It's speculative baggage added to the story as folklore and myth and Christmas legend over the years. A few storytelling embellishments here, pushed a little too hard there, with troubling results in the end as far as Matthew's Gospel is concerned. Even if you look in our pew Bible, the good old NRSV lets us down on this one, calling these visitors wise men, which still misses the mark. For a start, there's nothing in the story to suggest these visitors are royalty, rich maybe, but royalty? I don't think so. And the word is simple enough in the text. The word is magi, as in magician, astrologer, stargazer. They're scholars, interpreters of constellations and the signs in the sky, keepers of secret knowledge, mystical advisors, fortune tellers. No doubt gifted with wisdom and a unique skill set, certainly educated, probably from Persia or perhaps Babylon. Old Testament super scholar Walter Brueggemann observes they've likely been reading Isaiah and other Hebrew scriptures. They're well read, they're well informed. Sure, they're wise men, sure. But they say so little in this story, only one sentence. We don't know their number, their mode of transport, if there were men and women in the group. What do we know? A group of astrologers from an eastern land have come to Jerusalem looking for a new Jewish king. They have observed an evocative astrological event of some sort, the rising star of the king of the Jews. Now, for centuries, astronomers have speculated that the Magi observed the conjunction of Jupiter, Saturn, and the constellation Pisces. Others have said maybe it was Halley's Comet. Others have said maybe it was a supernova. Info junkies, you can Google that up later. There is actually a pretty great image of the night sky round about that time where you can see Jupiter and Saturn hanging out for a while. None of these theories quite fit, though. As the story tells us, and if you pay close attention, you'll see that the star first leads them to Jerusalem, and only after gleaning more information from local experts, Herod's court officials and Bible scholars, then it finally leads them to Bethlehem, and then it stops. Now that would be one tricky and highly mobile star. Now, the reality is, all this talk of astrology has been a bit of an embarrassment, a discomfort even for the church over the years. As you can imagine, as keepers of the religious order, they didn't have a lot of interest in promoting the practice. Over time, some have viewed the Magi as mostly sympathetic characters, earnest seekers of the truth, while others have taken pains to emphasize their status as freakish, disreputable characters, practicers of dark arts. We three kings. It's a much tidier package, and it will make for a beautiful offertory, I assure you, later in the service. Thank you, Gerald. Promoting Jesus as a king among kings is far better official church PR than recognizing the scandalous presence of pagan astrologers and fortune tellers. And yet God has invited these foreign strangers, aliens who practice their off-the-map religious life. This is not merely an awkward moment in the Epiphany story. This is the Epiphany story. The scandal of the story is the gospel of the story. The star that draws them, that star, by the way, one of God's greatest improv moments. The scriptures that guide them, even in the hands of Herod of all people, and dreams that warn them. All signs of God's lavish invitation, a wide and broad and surprising grace that abruptly ends any notion that God is only interested in a select group of people who have it all sorted. Grace for outsiders who didn't make the guest list. Grace for the rest of us. In the big, scraggy, overgrown family tree of church history, this is where most of us catch our first break. The story of the Magi is the story of the God who surprises us with the sort of riffraff he's invited to the party. There is a king in the story, though, at least for a little while. If the Magi are a symbol of God's great grace for all humanity, Herod is a healthy reminder of what a dark and cruel and selfish and self-destructive race we are. No question Herod makes for a larger-than-life villain, a crazy, paranoid murderer who killed most of his family and hunted babies. The really shocking part in the story, the part that always gets me, is that he took the time to read the scriptures, and he asked the opinion of the Bible scholars, not so he could know or understand God better, not so he could receive God's invitation, but so he could use the information in his futile attempt to hold on to his power and kill the Christ child. Frederick Dale Bruner, for my money, the very best Matthew commentator anywhere, suggests that the Magi, along with Herod, sketch for us the full scope of humanity. We are at once recipients of more grace and abundance and favor than we can know, and we are capable of such cruelty and selfishness and resistance to that same grace. Is Herod just a horrible, cruel monster that none of us can relate to? Or does Herod just show us what the human race is capable of? Be it willful displays of destruction and violence, or complacent shrugs in the face of global calamity. This time last year, a good many celebrities and politicians and dignitaries, I guess kings of our age, made a great show of support and solidarity as they rallied around the cleanup and aid work in the wake of the disastrous Haitian earthquake. It was an inspiring sight. You know, deep down, maybe people aren't that bad. And when called upon, we really can pull together. And yet, 1 year later, with less than 5% of the actual work done, and much of the promised relief funds still unpaid, the Haitian cleanup effort has become one of the great embarrassments of the one of the great embarrassments of the shamefully selfish developed world. Note to self, make easier sentences to say. I'm embarrassed. Herod isn't just one creepy old king from Palestine. Herod is alive and well. He's the embodiment of how deeply we need the grace of God. Epiphany, God's startling revelation, Christ's striking appearance is this. The one who arranges and orders the stars arrives in the frailty and vulnerability of a human child with a price on his head and joins the big embarrassment called the human race. Every Old Testament promise that God has ever made, every declaration that he cares for people, ultimately expressed when God becomes a person. God's way of demonstrating just how involved, just how vested, just how serious he is about the burden of the human condition. The hope for the human race in a new human. Christ, the child, God's gift to the world. With varying degrees of fidelity, the church has done its best to live in Herod's world, while at the same time clinging to the promise that this child is God's striking appearance in our midst. Sometimes we've wandered. Sometimes we've lashed out. Always we live in the sphere of grace which envelops all of creation. The story of the Magi is a hope for a chaotic and unpredictable planet, a way to be oriented by the maker of all things. The story of the Magi is a guide and a sign for those of us who navigate this troubled world as agents of God's grace. Thanks be to God.